On June 1st, 1997, it was a young woman's 18th birthday, and she was headed to the city by the bay to attend UC Berkeley for a photography course. But after work one afternoon, she seemingly vanished into thin air. This is episode number 63. Tonight, I'm going to tell you about the disappearance of Kristen Modafferi.
Hello, and welcome back to the 3 a.m. Mystery Club podcast. I'm Brandon.
I'm Ro.
And I'm Derek.
As you heard from the intro, Derek is up tonight. He's back from haunting the streets of Hollywood. Are you ready to go?
I'm ready. I've wanted to tell you about this story for a while. It's a case that I keep going back to. I feel like every week I tell you I'm potentially going to cover this, and then I end up finding something else and doing that. Well, this week, it is time to shine some light on the Kristen Modafferi case. Kristen Modafferi was born on June 1st, 1979 in Danbury, Connecticut. Danbury is a very nice town bordering the state of New York. At that time, it had around 60,000 residents. Kristen was the second of four children born to Bob and Debbie Modafferi. She had an older sister named Allison and two younger sisters, Lauren and Megan. Kristen's father, Bob, worked as an electrical engineer. Her mom, Debbie, was a school teacher. When the girls were young, the Modafferis relocated from Danbury, Connecticut to Charlotte, North Carolina. Kristen was still in elementary school when the family relocated, so she pretty much grew up in Charlotte. Kristen has been described by her sisters as being a very funny and free-spirited person, and also very intelligent. The siblings attended Providence High School, where they did very well. During her time in high school, Kristen worked at a local pizza place so she could save money, all while getting excellent grades. She was such a great student that she received a scholarship which covered her college tuition for 4 years. After graduating from high school in 1996, she went to North Carolina State University in Raleigh, where she was an industrial design major. In 1997, Kristen Modafferi was an honors student and had just finished her freshman year at North Carolina State University. She was set to take a summer photography course and an elective at UC Berkeley. Kristen's parents were not enthusiastic about their daughter spending the summer across the country, but Kristen wanted to prove she could take care of herself independently. Not only was Kristen extremely bright, but everyone knew how passionate and creative she was as well. So ultimately, her parents knew she would excel in the photography class. In addition to finding the courses she wanted to take at Berkeley, the Modafferis had vacationed in San Francisco just a few years earlier, so Kristen likely felt a sense of familiarity and comfort. Kristen quickly got to work browsing the internet, searching for a place to live in the Bay Area. Since San Francisco rent was outrageously expensive, and I guess some things don't change, Kristen settled on an old Victorian home on 274 Jane Avenue in nearby Oakland. It was a 5-bedroom and 3-bathroom home built in 1911. In 1997, it was occupied by 4 young men, Justin, Griffin, Hans, and his brother Kurt. It was located about 5 miles from the UC Berkeley campus, so it felt perfect. I also want to say, it may seem strange to some that Kristen was going to live with these 4 guys, but from everything I've found, it didn't seem to be a weird setup at all. A room was actually available because one of the roommates, Griffin, had an amicable breakup with his girlfriend, Rosie, who was moving to Paris, France for the summer, and Kristen was to move into Rosie's old bedroom. Kristen arrived in California on June 1st, 1997, which was her 18th birthday, and classes were to begin on June 24th at Berkeley. So she allowed herself those 3 weeks to play tourist in her new city. Kristen knew that when the 24th rolled around, she would be working hard and supporting herself as well as going to school. On her second day in California, so on June 2nd, Kristen walked all over San Francisco, Oakland, and Berkeley, passing out resumes, determined to get a job. Along her route, with resumes in hand, Kristen walked into the Crocker Galleria Mall in the financial district of downtown San Francisco. She met Bernie Melvin, the manager of Spinelli's coffee shop, located within the mall. Bernie was so taken by Kristen's infectious personality and drive that she hired her on the spot, despite not having a need for a new employee. Bernie recalls remembering she didn't even have hours to offer, but Kristen seemed like such a perfect fit that she was determined to create hours for her. Just something that I wanted to mention here while I was researching this case, but it looks like at some point since then, since the 90s, Spinelli's closed and has since become Bernie's, which I would assume is the manager Bernie from Spinelli's. Like maybe she took over and owned the coffee place and it changed to Bernie's. That's not really relevant to our story right now. I just found that interesting when I was researching this and wanted to let you know that. In addition to Spinelli's, Kristen also got a second job for the weekends at a cafe in the Museum of Modern Art. Ever responsible, Kristen began work right away for those few weeks before classes and spent her free time in the afternoons exploring San Francisco. Though Kristen lived in Oakland for the more affordable rent, she enjoyed working and living her life in San Francisco. Kristen lived near Lake Merritt in downtown Oakland, a popular lake with fitness enthusiasts who love to walk and jog around the lake. Kristen's regular routine included traveling from Oakland to the mall, where Spinelli's was located in downtown San Francisco. She would commute by foot past the lake to the BART station. For those not familiar, BART is the Bay Area Rapid Transit subway system that serves San Francisco, Oakland, and Berkeley, etc. She would then walk 2 blocks to the mall, where Spinelli's coffee was located as soon as you walked in on the ground floor. For 3 weeks, Kristen would make this trip to work, then explore the city afterwards, and would arrive home in Oakland at 10:30 or 11 p.m. On Monday, June 23rd, things changed. On that day, Kristen went into Spinelli's to work her usual shift. Tomorrow was a big day. Her classes were to begin at UC Berkeley, but she had one last free evening before school and work dominated her schedule. Kristen's coworkers at Spinelli specifically recall her talking about this, how she had one final evening free before school began. She had asked them what they recommended she do for the evening, but every idea they came up with, she had already done. At some point during the day, Kristen told her coworkers she wasn't sure, but she was thinking about going to Baker Beach, which is near the Golden Gate Bridge and not far from Land's End, both on the north coast of San Francisco. This was about 7 miles from her work in the opposite direction of where she lived. There are conflicting sources regarding Kristen's reasons to visit the beach. Some say there was a party on or near the beach, though to my knowledge, that party remains unidentified. Other sources say she wanted to take some photos at the beach, which could seem likely since she was starting a photography class just the next day. Some of her coworkers didn't even say she gave a reason for going to the beach, just that she had asked for directions. So it's not really known why she was interested in the beach that day. Kristen Spinelli's shift ended that afternoon somewhere between 3 and 3:30. Her coworkers, assuming she was likely heading to the beach as she mentioned, but about 45 minutes after her shift ended, some of her coworkers spotted her on the second floor of the mall, walking shoulder to shoulder with a young blonde woman. To this day, that woman has never been identified. This stood out to her coworkers because Kristen didn't usually hang out around the Galleria after her shift. But this woman was the last person spotted with Kristen. It's also not known if she ever went to the beach that day. This sighting with that young blonde woman was the last known sighting of Kristen Mottaferri. Kristen's parents have pleaded with the unidentified woman through the media to come forward several times, but no one ever has. When Kristen left the mall that fateful day, she was wearing a black Spinelli's t-shirt, a long-sleeved blue plaid flannel shirt, tan pants, and possibly high-top fly London sneakers. She had a green JanSport backpack with a couple of library books inside. Concern grew when Kristen did not show up to pick up her check on payday at Spinelli's. Not only did she not show up to get her check, but her roommates noted she didn't come home on the night of June 23rd, the night she was asking about directions to Baker Beach and spotted with that unidentified blonde woman at the mall. At first, her roommates didn't think it was that weird. She had only lived with them a few weeks, and they didn't have her schedule memorized, especially since it was changing with school on the horizon. For all they knew, she was on a date or with friends. This was 1997, so cell phones were not the norm. I know we say that a lot on this podcast, but it's true. It wasn't as easy to reach people back then. On June 25th, the day after her photography course began, and 2 days since she was last seen, Kristen's father, Bob, called the house and left a message with one of Kristen's housemates to have her call him when she got home. Though the housemate didn't mention he hadn't seen her in 2 days. Then the next morning, which was Thursday, she still hadn't returned home. Now her housemates did begin to worry, especially after they heard from Kristen's coworkers that she had missed work. Bob Mottaferri called the house once again that day to check on his daughter. Bob was concerned, but he knew her schedule was packed and he was hoping that she had just been too busy to get back to him. Unfortunately, those fears were amplified when Bob was told by Kristen's housemates they hadn't seen her in 3 days and that she had missed work. Bob and Debbie wasted no time and boarded a flight for the Bay Area the next morning. On June 27th, after landing in San Francisco, her parents went to the Oakland Police Department to report Kristen missing. But it was a Friday, and investigators had put her case on hold until Monday the 30th. That had to have been so awful for Bob and Debbie. They flew across the country to find their daughter, but were told they had to wait a couple of more days because Kristen was an adult and this was just how it was handled, at least then. The Mottaferris then went to the house where Kristen was living to search her room. They immediately found a local newspaper from San Francisco, the Bay Guardian, in Kristen's trash can, with a personal ad that was circled. It read, "Friends, female seeking friends to share activities who enjoy music, photography, working out, walks, coffee, or simply the beach. Exploring the Bay Area. Interested? Call me." Unfortunately, the Bay Guardian was not able to determine if Kristen placed the ad or if someone else placed the ad and Kristen had responded to it. The newspaper had already gotten rid of the records by the time Bob and Debbie brought it to their attention. It is known Kristen enjoyed coffee, even working at a coffee shop, and clearly she loved photography and the beach. But did she write the ad? Did she respond to it? I think, personally, if she did write the ad, it seems odd that she would have circled her own ad. It remains a very frustrating mystery for those searching for answers. And in case you aren't familiar, at least in the 90s, when ads like these were placed, a general number was provided that people would call to respond to ads. No personal phone numbers were given. That's part of the reason it's not known who even placed the ad to begin with. When investigators spoke with Kristen's coworkers, they found out from at least one of them, Kristen had mentioned possibly taking pictures at Land's End Lookout. Land's End is an area near Baker Beach where the famous Cliff House restaurant sat for many years. I say sat because sadly, I believe the Cliff House was a casualty of the pandemic and isn't around anymore. But I've been inside this restaurant. It's stunning. It's sitting on a cliff overlooking the ocean. It is gorgeous. It attracts lots of tourists as well as locals who dined in the restaurant while overlooking the crashing waves. Police immediately went to the beach and Land's End with bloodhounds. Bloodhounds actually tracked Kristen Scent to the Muni 38 Geary bus. So I mentioned earlier that BART is the transportation system in the Bay Area that travels around San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, all the outside areas of San Francisco as well. Muni is the local bus and subway system serving the city of San Francisco specifically, just to clarify. So this bloodhound tracked Kristen Scent from the Muni 38 Geary Street bus, which is a major street in San Francisco, from the stop outside of the mall. Her trail was also picked up near the end of that bus route and all the way to the edge of a cliff at Land's End. Now, the area of Land's End is very scenic and it would be perfect for taking stunning photographs. I could easily see someone getting close to the edge while taking pictures. And while the last scent being picked up near the edge of a cliff was definitely cause for concern, there was zero evidence that Kristen or anyone else had fallen off of the cliff. As I mentioned, Land's End is a very popular tourist destination, and this was also peak tourist season. So many believed it would be unlikely something would have happened to her here without someone seeing it. But with that being said, I spoke with my friend Gianni, who has lived in San Francisco since the late 90s, and he said there are so many hiking trails and hidden areas complete with cliffs and rocks and all kinds of crazy natural stuff around Land's End that he thinks something easily could have happened to someone without anyone seeing it. The Modaferries soon put up a $10,000 reward in hopes of finding out what happened to Kristen, though no real leads came through and the family began to feel hopeless. Bob and Debbie eventually went on the Maury Povich show to increase awareness and up the reward to $50,000. Then an anonymous donor donated 20 billboards around the San Francisco area to help the family. Then about 2 weeks after Kristen disappeared, on July 10th, 1997, police got a tip from KGO-TV, an ABC news station in San Francisco, that a man called in claiming to, quote, know what really happened to Kristen Modaferri. He said Kristen was involved in a lesbian love triangle and was murdered by two women who then disposed of her body under a wooden bridge near Point Reyes, California, about an hour's drive north of San Francisco. Police traced the call to 36-year-old John Onuma, who happened to live near the Crocker Galleria where Kristen worked at Spinelli's. John initially denied being the one to make the call, though he eventually admitted he did, but says he lied. The two women he implicated had been allegedly giving his girlfriend a hard time at work, so he wanted to get back at them. When the two women were called in for questioning, they gave a different story. They worked at the YMCA with John's girlfriend, Jill. They had work issues with her and were preparing to fire her when John Onuma began harassing them.
How wild is that, that somebody would use a missing person case to try to, you know, frame somebody else or implicate somebody else just to like get back at them? That's a bit much.
Yeah, I thought that was very crazy. These women allegedly had an issue with his girlfriend, and his solution is, oh, let's call the cops and tell them that these two women killed that missing woman. Very, very strange reaction, to say the least.
Yeah. And how many times have we heard that rumor that, oh, there must be some kind of lesbian affair going on in our stories? Like, that's happened in so many of our cases, even if this one was just totally made up.
It's like just the thing people say or something.
Yeah.
Naturally, all of this started to make John look very suspicious. Some listeners of ours may be wondering if one of these two women was blonde, like that strange woman in the mall. Unfortunately, the information has never been confirmed or denied that I'm aware of. Then another female witness came forward and alleged that John had abused and threatened to kill her shortly after Kristen disappeared. The woman stated that John said, quote, now you know what happened to Kristen Modaferri, quote. In addition to this, multiple other women have come forward alleging to have been raped or tortured by John Onuma. It has been said that John's then girlfriend, Jill, was the one that lured women to John for him to hurt. In 1999, John Onuma was actually featured in an episode of America's Most Wanted. The show presented three women who claimed they were held against their will and tortured by him. The alleged torture supposedly included sleep deprivation and being burned. On the TV show, one of the women called Onuma a human vampire. Another said she was his sex slave, and the third said he beat her when she tried to escape. One of them quoted Onuma as saying, quote, "You know I'm going to have to kill you. I can't let you go. Now you know what happened to Kristen Mottaferri," quote. A search of John Onuma's home was then conducted. Authorities found Jill's journal with missing pages from the exact time that Kristen disappeared. It needs to be said that Jill was a brunette, so unless she was wearing a wig, it was not the woman that Kristen was spotted walking around the second floor of the mall with. But very strange that just random pages were ripped out of her journal that happened to be around the time Kristen disappeared. To make things even weirder, John's San Francisco apartment had large amounts of cat blood. So at first this blood was discovered, and when it was analyzed, it was revealed that it wasn't from Kristen or even a person, it was from a cat. So why did this guy have like crazy amount of cat blood in his apartment is very strange. In this look into John Onuma, it was also discovered that he placed personal ads in local newspapers looking for women.
Oh, there was a newspaper in Kristen's trash can, right?
Yes, there was. There was an ad looking for a female friend. And the ad was circled, like I mentioned earlier, and it's not known if Kristen wrote the ad, which it does seem weird she would write the ad and then circle her own ad and throw it away, or if she was responding to one. But it does look like John Onuma had a history of writing ads to find women.
And they couldn't figure out if that ad was from him?
I really don't understand how they couldn't, but it doesn't seem like that was ever confirmed. A little more about John. Within 2 years of Kristen's disappearance, John moved to Hawaii, where he was evicted in 2002 from a $1.4 million home. It's not known if John was from Hawaii or if he had some sort of connection to it, but some have called this suspicious. The property manager searched the home and found a briefcase of John's located in the attic, containing various articles about Kristen Mottaferri. How creepy is that?
Yeah, not at all, Randy. Not a red flag at all.
Some have said maybe he hid the bag up in the attic and then moved and forgot that it was up there or something, but very odd to find a briefcase in the attic and then to open it up and they find all these articles about Kristen. Another fascinating connection is apparently John's ex-girlfriend Jill had dated a guy named Matthew Luke, who worked at Spinelli's Coffee with Kristen. Matthew says he knows absolutely nothing about what happened to Kristen and maintains innocence regarding the whole thing. Was it possible Kristen had given info to Matthew, which was then relayed to Jill, who maybe told John? No one really knows, but there does seem to be a connection between those people. Later in 2015, an independent search of the Oakland house Kristen had been living in when she disappeared was completed. During the search, a cadaver dog with a world-class reputation alerted to the presence of human remains in the basement. Paul Dosti, a former Mammoth Lakes police sergeant and owner of the dog, suggested that Oakland police excavate a concrete slab in the basement and proposed that Kristen's roommates at the time be re-interviewed by law enforcement. Dr. Arpad Voss, a forensic anthropologist from the University of Tennessee, visited the house in February of 2017 and scanned the area with a proprietary device he developed, which detects human composition with chemicals. The device pinpointed between 274 Jane Avenue and the house next door, 278 Jane Avenue. I also need to mention at this point that the house next to Kristen at the time was actually a halfway house for, I believe, people that had violated parole or something. So that might be worth noting. There's not a lot of details beyond that, but I think that's interesting enough to mention, especially since possible human remains were spotted in between the two. Dosti stated that the results of those searches likely indicated a crime scene rather than a burial. Aside from a concrete slab, the home's basement floor consisted of hard-packed clays, which would be difficult to dig with a standard shovel. Additionally, a chemical signature denoting the presence of human blood was discovered near a concrete slab at the base of the porch steps of the 278 residence, the house next door. DNA testing revealed that the decomposing material matched that of Bob and Debbie Modafferi, who had provided samples for testing. This would make it seem likely Kristen's blood could have been at the base of those steps of that house next door. In response to their findings, the Oakland Police's public information officer, Felicia Aisthorpe, states that their findings needed to be confirmed by the city police and claimed the information had yet to be delivered to their department. At this time, the information we need from Dr. Voss to collect samples for his human composition testing has not been forwarded to the department. Additionally, no information regarding the more recent blood testing conducted on the porch has been disclosed to the department. Dosti and Voss denied this to be the case, stating that the Oakland Police Department had enough data to undertake their own tests. Voss stated, "All Oakland Police Department needs to do is bring their own dogs out to that site and see what happens. I'm quite sure that Paul also told OPD how to look for human-specific volatile organic compounds in collected soil samples. All you need is a GCMS, gas chromatograph, coupled with a mass spectrometer, which every university or crime lab in the world has. The procedure is very straightforward." Brandon, I thought about you in particular when I read this part, because I know I've covered cases in the past and you've asked if specific notorious alleged killers had any rumored involvement in any of my cases. Well, one has been mentioned with Kristen Modafferi. Some have mentioned the possibility that real estate heir Robert Durst had some involvement with her disappearance.
Ooh.
Yes, and the reason he's been mentioned is because he was reportedly living in Northern California at the time of Kristen's disappearance, and it's also known that he has a history with cross-dressing, and some have asked, could the blonde woman Kristen was seen with in the mall have been Robert Durst in disguise? Doesn't seem very likely to me, but who knows? I mean, he does allegedly have that history. Kristen's Act was introduced in 1999 and signed into law by President Bill Clinton in 2000. Since April 2001, Kristen's Law provided assistance to law enforcement and families in missing person cases of those over the age of 17 and authorized $1 million per year to support organizations including the National Center for Missing Adults. The center's federal funding ran out in 2005 when Kristen's Law expired. It has continued with volunteer efforts. Kristen Modafferi's case has been featured on Unsolved Mysteries, Primetime Live, and America's Most Wanted. It remains unsolved.
So, I mean, we're pretty sure the John guy had something to do with this, right?
To my knowledge, he's never been charged with anything, but he does seem like a very suspicious figure in all of this.
Yeah, I mean, he even, you know, had his own episode of America's Most Wanted. And I can't help but get, every time I hear a story of the girlfriend helping lure victims in, I just get a nauseated feeling. It reminds me of the case you did, Ro, the Canadian case?
Yeah, the Ken and Barbie killers.
Yeah, I always think of that now.
Oh, yeah, and it's so gross, too. It's just, ugh.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, are they doing it just to, like, please their man, or are they, like, or do they have a sadistic side as well?
To me, I would imagine it's a little bit of both.
That's what I think.
I want to go back to the spectrometer or the special testing.
Yes.
That is actually a similar method is how they determined that Aunt Judy was in fact murdered instead of just, you know, expired and then set, and then the place caught on fire. Like that a test similar to that, like a modified version of that test, is what determined that she was in fact murdered.
I was thinking that sounded familiar. That's probably what I was thinking of your episode.
Yeah, because there was something with the gases that if she had inhaled carbon monoxide, it would have shown up in that test. And if she had not, which means that she had died before the building was set on fire, it would have been a different result. So that, I just thought that was interesting, that it piqued my interest when you mentioned that test.
That is very interesting. And I don't know what made me think of this, but I want to bring up something. While researching this episode, I heard several people mention that though Kristen was extremely bright and smart, some people described her as naive when it came to like city living in San Francisco. And the one example I'd heard someone give that stood out to me was that I guess at some point, like before her disappearance, she had like tried to sleep in a train station or something, like after a concert, like the train had stopped running or something. Like there was some reason why she couldn't get back home and she thought, oh, I'm just gonna sleep on this bench. And a man had warned her that she should not sleep there and it wasn't safe. So again, this is totally unrelated to her actual disappearance, but that behavior stood out to me as someone that could potentially put themselves at risk.
Yeah. It sounds like you said Danbury was a really nice area. So it sounds like she lived a pretty good and safe life while she was there.
I think so. She primarily grew up in Charlotte. She was born in Danbury, but lived most of her life in Charlotte. But I think to your point, she lived a nice life and was, I don't want to use
sheltered, maybe. Yeah.
Yes, and I hesitate to use the word sheltered because I wouldn't normally think of a sheltered person as being someone who moves across the country like that, especially with their parents like kind of okaying it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, at the same time, oddly, I feel like she was sheltered.
I mean, I've not lived in the city ever, but even I can be naive sometimes, but even I'm like, no, like you don't sleep in public places.
Yeah, I thought that bit of information was interesting. And something that I've also heard that didn't get brought up was that I guess being a bunch of young guys like living in that house with her, they were always all like kind of in and out. So at first it probably didn't really stand out to them that she wasn't there because one, she had just moved there. She was 18. She was working and going to school. They don't know her schedule, but also she's living with multiple people who are living their own lives and not necessarily paying attention to the fact that she's not there until they really realize, wow, she's not here. And I have found there have been podcast episodes specifically on her roommates, because you know, a lot of these cases we cover, there are podcasts. We will cover a case in 45 minutes, and then we will find another podcast that will have multiple episodes about each case. And one of the Kristen Modafferi multiple episode podcast I found has an episode just on the roommates, which I admit I have not been able to dive into yet. I have not listened to it. I only know basic information about her roommates, but there are just so many potential paths this case could take. I don't know where someone should look first, but John Onuma seems, I see why he's a front and center suspect.
Yeah, he's probably number one on my list. Now, the halfway house, we should probably mention this was in the 90s, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so before anybody comments on anything, the sex offender registry was not a thing back then. Like, you could know it was a halfway house, but you wouldn't necessarily know what it was a halfway house for.
You're right. And all I found about that is it just says that it was a halfway house for people that violated parole, but it doesn't say like what kind of crimes or anything.
Right. Right. So I felt like maybe before somebody comes on and says, well, couldn't they have checked that before she even moved in? No, you could not back then.
Good point. I didn't even realize you couldn't do that back then.
Yeah. Cause that's been a 2000s kind of thing. Okay.
So this was just right before that then.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say I would be so so itching to dig up around those steps to see what was buried under there.
This is the second case I can think of that we've covered right off the top of my head where there's been a potential structure with remains inside where they don't just dig it up.
Yeah, I was thinking of the Springfield 3 when you said that.
Yes, the parking structure in the Springfield 3.
Yeah, it just blows my mind that, you know, that there could be, that could solve that case and that, you know, this could solve this case.
It just, from the outside looking in, it doesn't seem like every avenue is being explored. If there are these obvious potential locations of remains and they're not being looked at.
For sure.
You know, I'd like to imagine if we all three were like city planners or budgeters, like how over budget will we be if we followed like all these hunches? Like there's proof that someone's buried under that house, demolish it.
Exactly.
We would run the budget into the ground.
It would be like, oh, that building's been there long enough. Let's get rid of it and make sure there's not, you know, remains under it.
It's fine. We can afford it. Let's just do it. I need to see what's under there.
What do we do, budget chair Rowena? Demolish it.
I'll allow it.
There might be bodies under there.
Okay, on that note, I'm going to wrap this up. But it's unbelievable that Kristen Mottaferri has still not been found. And here's hoping that one day she will be and we will have answers.
If you enjoyed this episode and you want to dig into it a little bit more with some pictures, our source notes and things like that, you can follow us on social media. We're on all the big ones, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Also, we have a sale going on, a moving sale in our old merch store where you can get 20% off your purchase right now on fun little things like hoodies, mugs, t-shirts, that kind of stuff. You can also check that out in our show notes, and the link is on our website, freeammysteryclub.com.